The United Nations says more than 300 people have been killed by government airstrikes in East Ghouta, Syria this month, hundreds more wounded, and they're in desperate need of medical attention. David Miliband is CEO of the International Rescue Committee and a former British Member of Parliament. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome back, David. And first of all, I know you've seen the same scenes that we have of East Ghouta on TV. They are truly shocking. But how bad are things there right now?
Well, the Secretary General of the United Nations yesterday said it was the modern definition of hell. And I think that is the right description, because human life is not just hanging by a thread, it's being lost. The International Rescue Committee, which I lead, has five hospitals that we're supporting in Ghouta. One of them bombed yesterday. We literally have doctors having to reuse syringes. We have credible reports of starving children. And of course, there is death and destruction from the air of an absolutely abhorrent kind.
And these are government airstrikes on rebel-held areas.
Government and Russian-supported airstrikes. Obviously, the conflict in Syria has become more complicated over the last 6 or 7 years since it began as a rather basic demand for accountable government and respect for individual freedom in Daraa in 2011, with people writing graffiti on walls. It's now a much more complicated conflict. But the essential problem at its heart, namely that the combatants to the conflict are paying no heed at all to the basics of human life or international humanitarian law, has become worse and worse, from chemical weapons to now this mass bombardment, not just in Ghouta, but where there's a siege, but in the northwest of the country, 400,000 people displaced from their homes by bombing in the last 2.5 weeks. So any hope that 2017 was going to see the end of the Syrian war, I think, is being dashed. 2018 is on track to be a bloodier year than even last year.
And insofar as these actions being taken in defiance of international law, I mean, tell me a little bit more about that. Were civilians given any opportunity to evacuate the area before the bombing began?
No, I mean, the opposite. The civilians are being kept into the area.
Targeted,
these are not
right.
Underground hospitals. These are well-marked hospitals. It's a deliberate campaign of indiscriminate bombing that on civilian areas. That's why people talk about war crimes, because international humanitarian law is absolutely clear after the Second World War that there is a responsibility on combatants in a conflict to spare civilians. And that is not being done both in Ghouta and elsewhere in this conflict. Obviously, the entry of the Russians in 2015 changed the dynamics of this conflict. The Obama administration was very worried, for understandable reasons, that any engagement on the military side would suck it in to a conflict. The Russians have proved that you can apply the iron fist in collaboration with the Syrian government and their Iranian backers and retake significant parts of the country, but of course not get to the heart of the political division in the country, because the scale of the bloodshed, the scale of the exodus of people into neighboring states, 5 or 6 million refugees, means that it's very hard to see how there's any kind of political compromise or political settlement in sight.
So tell me a bit more about the humanitarian efforts, the medical efforts that are going on in East Ghouta right now. I mean, how many hospitals does the IRC work with there?
We support 5 hospitals out of 19 in the area. I mean, the doctors and nurses who remain are extraordinary people, and now they have very little choice but to stay because they're sealed off. We know there are 700 to 800 people in desperate need of evacuation because they've got illnesses and diseases that need more or less immediate treatment if they are to survive. We also know that the basic primary care infrastructure, the basic care, the dialysis machines that are needed for kidney patients, the basic support for diabetics is being lost. We get supplies into there. We support the doctors and the nurses running the 5 hospitals that we support. But we are in a mission there to just keep hope, keep life going.
And but you said a little earlier that the situation is so dire that doctors have to do things such as reuse needles.
Yeah. So that's why Secretary General Guterres is right to say it's close to hell. It's the violation of every conceivable norm. And I'm afraid there's no shame on the part of the Iranian or Russian backers of the Assad regime. They'd trot out this line that they're taking on terrorists. There's very little accountability. So I want to know who are the people who ordered the bombing of the hospital that we run? And there's no accountability for that. Obviously, the trauma for the West of Afghanistan and Iraq means that there is enormous political caution in Western countries about getting involved in a conflict like that in Syria. But that means that there's free rein for people who are dissolving the very basics of humanity.
Sometimes it feels very strange to me that we are able to have this conversation in a sort of dispassionate, clinical way when the truth of what we're talking about is almost immeasurable human suffering.
Well, I don't feel dispassionate about it at all. I feel extremely passionate and angry about it because the betrayal of the civilians, the betrayal of the aid workers, we're a humanitarian charity. We have local people. It's local nurses, local doctors, local community workers who work for the International Rescue Committee. And they are there doing the essentials of humanitarian work with very little political support. So their work is meant to be clinical, but I don't think our discussion of it is clinical. What our discussion is impotent. And that is the real story of the diplomatic and political failure that Syria represents.
So let's talk about that, because I think that's a very good word to use here. What is preventing the international community? I mean, you've mentioned the UN Secretary General a couple of times. What is preventing the international community to at least put more pressure on Assad to implement some kind of ceasefire?
There's a simple answer to that, which is the Russian veto in the United Nations Security Council is blocking Security Council action. We know Sweden and Kuwait, who are two temporary members, two-year members of the UN Security Council, have got a resolution down being discussed at the moment to call for a 30-day halt in the fighting and in the bombing, and that is being blocked by the Russians. We'll see whether or not the Chinese support them or whether the Chinese abstain. This follows a record of 12 or 15 similar vetoes that the Russians have applied. Now, the real test of diplomacy, of course, is not just to pass resolutions. It's what do you do when resolutions are blocked? Where is the political pressure? Where is the shame, which is a word that I've used before? Where is the linkage of actions on the Syria front to other questions where Russia or Iran have interests in the wider international system? I talk about a crisis of diplomacy because we know that the State Department is massively under strength when it comes to the deployment of ambassadors. We know that the Trump administration has said it wants to cut by 30% the amount of the number of diplomats, but also the amount of humanitarian aid. That retreat of the US is absolutely fundamental to understanding the kind of remit and impunity that exists for other actors in the international system at the moment. Because when Western countries withdraw, for all of our own faults, not to say we're perfect at all, but when we withdraw, it leaves room for very bad actors to fill the void.
And you think there are no other members of the Security Council who could step up to fill the void?
Well, there are, but remember the point about the five permanent members of the Security Council is they have a veto. So you can't pass a resolution against a veto. I mean, the US has a veto, France has a veto.
But to your point about diplomacy and finding the pathways to move forward when the threat of the veto looms constantly.
Well, the crisis of diplomacy is not just the Russian veto. The crisis of diplomacy, I live and work in New York. We're a New York headquartered humanitarian organization. In September, the world gathers in New York for the UN General Assembly. Where were the all-night sessions on Syria? Where were the all-night sessions on Yemen? Where were the all-night sessions on South Sudan? They are being lost in a definition of America's interests that is very narrow. And in a way, the approach of the administration over the last year, just to pick, to say ISIS is the be-all and end-all of American interests in Syria, has been to fall into a trap that President Assad of Syria laid 6 or 7 years ago. And he's now got the fight that he wanted. And that is a true crisis because, remember, what starts in Syria doesn't stay in Syria. Mm-hmm. It spills into Jordan and Lebanon. Jordan is the second closest ally of the United States in the Middle East. The refugees spill into Turkey. They spill into Europe. 1.5 million refugees have landed in Europe. And one of the fundamental issues that a humanitarian organization sees every day is that in an interdependent world, the problems of one country aren't confined to that country. They spill out. And either we have a sense of global conscience that learns the lessons of history, that says the untended humanitarian crisis is the source of political instability, not just the product of it, or we fail to learn that lesson at our own cost.
Well, David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. His recent book is Rescue, Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.